Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Lost in Science. Yes, it is the greatest science show that people get lost in on the airwaves, the sound devices, all those phenomena. Joining me are the effervescent Lyndon and Stu. Lyndon, how are you?
I'm feeling effervescent, Chris. That's a perfect adjective for my emotions today. How are you?
Look, I think that's a good thing. I am kind of gassy. let's just put it that way. Stu, how about you?
I don't know how effervescent I'm feeling, but vescent enough, I suppose.
Okay, that'll have to do. Lyndon, did you bring us a sparkling story?
I did, yes. Actually, I did bring quite a gaseous story this week, in that it's more of an interview. It's an interview with an atmospheric chemist. I'm pulling from my own Rolodex this week, speaking to a colleague of mine, Dr. Rob Ryan at the University of Melbourne. Rob's an atmospheric chemist, and he is going to chat to us this week about a recent study he published looking at the role of clear skies on the Great Barrier Reef. Right, so we know that the Great Barrier Reef is in more and more trouble every year. It's having more frequent bleaching events as the ocean gets hotter and things get hotter. But Rob and his team were doing a study looking at the types of weather conditions that lead to better conditions for the reef and worse conditions for the reef. Yeah, and as Rob's going to talk about, you know, sometimes good things can have unintended negative consequences. So look forward to that chat. He's a very thoughtful scientist, Dr. Rob Ryan, so I think it'll be a good convo.
It sounds complicated, which is where science comes in, doesn't it? speaking of complicated science, Stu.
Well, have I got some complicated science for you? Actually, I'm going away from complicated science. I'm going to DIY science. Well, actually, sort of do it to yourself science. I was reminded the other day of a classic Nobel Prize winner who also happened to be Australian, who did a bit of DIY science to himself and proved the rest of gastroenterology wrong some years ago. But it was also another story which flowed on from that about another scientist using themselves as an experimental testing ground.
The famous Dr. Jekyll, is that who you're referring to?
No, he didn't. Well, he did change into someone less pleasant and then changed himself back again. So you'll have to stay tuned to find out more, because if I give the game away now, who will keep listening?
Well, everyone will, because we are so fantastic, and there is a lot to learn and to hear about. So look, I cannot wait to hear more about this, Stu and Lyndon. So on with the show.
Welcome back. You are listening to Lost in Science, and we're exploring the surprising this week, possibly the unexpected, answers that maybe the researchers didn't anticipate when they started their project. And to continue in that theme, I'm joined now by Dr. Rob Ryan, who is a research fellow at the School of Geography, Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Melbourne. Rob, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Lyndon. Cool to be here.
Now, you're an atmospheric chemist, and the project that I wanted to talk to you about today is something to do with the Great Barrier Reef. Tell me, what on earth does an atmospheric chemist have to do with the Great Barrier Reef? Like, one's in the sky and one's in the sea. What are you doing there?
Yeah, it's a great question. So atmospheric chemists play an interesting role at the Great Barrier Reef. We are interested in all of the molecules that go into the air from all sorts of different sources. So they could be from fires on land and drifting out over the reef. It could be air pollutants that humans emit from ships or from other types of transport. But there are also actually lots of components of the atmosphere that come out of the water themselves. So, for example, different organisms in the water emit things into the air through the water. And a lot of these things play really interesting roles in the climate system. So a lot of these molecules go on to make particles, and those particles interact with sunlight. So, circling back to the reef, if we want to understand how the Great Barrier Reef is changing, we need to know how the temperature and the sunlight are changing, reaching the reef. And so the atmospheric chemistry, which is interacting with that solar radiation, is a really important part of the story.
This project that you have published on recently, let me see if I can get the acronym right, you are working with the Reef Restoration and Adaptation Program, which is a national program, is that right?
Yeah, funded by the Great Barrier Reef Marine Trust.
Okay. And you were charged with what?
So my role is to look into all of the different things that humans are putting into the atmosphere that might interact with radiation and therefore interact with the future health of corals. And so this story starts actually when I first went out on fieldwork at the Great Barrier Reef.
Oh, so this is fieldwork. This isn't you sitting in a computer modelling different things. You got to go out to the reef.
I got to go out to the reef, mm-hmm. and I got to take some measurements of aerosols, particles, clouds, and the natural atmospheric environment out at the reef. And so the start of the story, though, is even before I got there, and I left the port of Gladstone on my way to Heron Island, and I passed through a whole forest of ships. And they were there, of course, for the coal port and a lot of the other associated industry in Gladstone. And I thought, wow, there are a lot of ships here. And I could see the plumes of pollution coming from the ships. And I wondered in that moment what the impact of those ships was on the atmosphere above the Great Barrier Reef. So that's what I set out to answer in this study. So the Reef Restoration and Adaptation Program had a huge measurement campaign out there comprising of a huge number of different measurement types. So everything from a plane flying through the atmosphere, a little Cessna, mm-hmm. a small aircraft. Apparently it wasn't very comfortable in there.
full of instruments, right?
Full of instruments and sweaty scientists. But so they were sampling the air at different altitudes. And then we had people with drones flying up and down, doing vertical transects through the atmosphere, collecting meteorological and aerosol particle information. My specialty is actually using the sunlight itself to tell us about atmospheric chemistry. So the sunlight comes in a spectrum through the UV and the visible, all the way up to longer wavelengths, and there's a fingerprint of different molecules that absorb and reflect and scatter that radiation. And so with a spectrometer on the ground, I can infer a lot about atmospheric composition just by measuring that sunlight spectrum. So that was what I was doing on a little island called One Tree Island next to Heron Island. But there were lots of other things that people were doing with planes and drones and LIDARs, sending a laser beam up into the air to collect aerosol information too. Yeah, there was a large program of things.
Wow. So it sounds like you then had a lot of ground truth or sky truth information that you could then bring back to use to calibrate and verify your computer model.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's wonderful. And probably quite rare, I think. There'd be a lot of places in the world where you wouldn't have access to so many different types of data sets to help understand what was going on.
Yeah, very rare and completely unprecedented at the Great Barrier Reef.
Ah, fascinating. Okay, so with all of those data and then with your computer simulations of what was happening, what did you find? You saw this forest of ships. You were trying to understand what their role was. I know that we've had some variations in emissions from ships. I'm thinking also around COVID times, you know, where a lot of transport stopped, and we saw that in the global record of temperature. We saw it in the global record of incoming and outgoing radiation as we had fewer, you know, what are they called? plane trails in the sky. That had an impact on the amount of sunlight coming in. What did you find when it came to ships?
Yeah, so actually at the same time that COVID was going on at its absolute worst, there was a big change made to shipping emissions by the International Maritime Organization. So there'd been discussions over many years about the fact that port cities, including a place like Gladstone, but of course there's many ports in the world that are much bigger, they were having real air pollution issues from ships. And those air pollution issues ranged from the fact that particles are really bad to breathe in, especially the really fine particulate matter. But in addition to that, there is a compound in the shipping fuel called sulfur dioxide, which, when it goes into the atmosphere, can go on to form sulfuric acid. Mm. And that is something that's responsible for acid rain. And this has been a major problem in really large port cities of the world. For example, think of places like Singapore, Shanghai, Mumbai, all of these large places in the world with huge ports, even Rotterdam, for example, in Europe. So the International Maritime Organization said we need to do something about this, and we're going to therefore cut the amount of sulfur dioxide that's going to come out of shipping fuel. And they cut the amount of sulfur dioxide by 80%, a huge cut.
Wow.
And all reports are that this has had a fantastic impact on reducing the acid rain and the particulate matter production in port cities. However,
okay.
Unfortunately, there's a but to this story, and this is where the surprising result comes in. When you reduce the amount of sulfur dioxide, you reduce the amount of sulfuric acid, and the sulfuric acid is in the form of a particle in the atmosphere that interacts with radiation. So reducing the amount of sulfate aerosol has increased the amount of sunlight that can come through the atmosphere to the surface, to the ocean, for example.
Mm.
And that has had, we believe, a climate warming impact. It has, another way to think about this is that the previous existence of all of this sulfate aerosol from shipping was masking a little bit of global warming, because it was reflecting some sunlight away from the Earth that otherwise would have come in to be reabsorbed by greenhouse gases.
Oh, so it was acting as more of a shield, and now that it's not there, there's more of the sun's energy coming into the ocean, which means for the reef, an increased warming over that area. Is that what you found?
Yeah, exactly. So there had previously been a range of studies looking at the global potential impact of the shipping emission change.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to know what the impact was specifically on the Great Barrier Reef. So compared to those previous studies, we ran model simulations at much finer resolution, focusing on the really specific weather and the really specific conditions at the Great Barrier Reef. And we focused on a time in our model simulations in 2022 when the Great Barrier Reef experienced a mass coral bleaching event. So we wanted to look at the weather in the lead up to this event. So what we did is we simulated how the atmosphere would have behaved if the ship emissions were as they used to be prior to this regulation. And then we simulated a scenario with the emissions as they are now, post the regulation.
Mm-hmm.
And we took the difference between those two simulations. And what that told us is that there is a substantial amount more sunlight coming into the Great Barrier Reef under those bleaching likely weather conditions. So if the Great Barrier Reef experiences weather that's likely to lead to bleaching anyway, it's now got a lot more sunlight coming in than it used to. And that spells trouble under those bleaching conditions.
Oh, wow. That is an unintended consequence, isn't it? So then my final question to you is, were you able in this study to offer any advice? Surely you weren't suggesting, as a result of these findings, go and chuck some more sulfur dioxide back into the fuel. Did you have any suggestions?
So absolutely, we are not advocating ever for increasing air pollution, because the short-term health impacts of air pollution and acid rain are devastating. So fully support the regulation. There's two things really that come out of this study. One is the urgency for us as humanity to act on reducing greenhouse gas emissions, because the changes that we've seen at the Great Barrier Reef are matching up with changes that we're seeing in how air pollution is reducing in some parts of the world. it's having a climate warming, a rebound effect, if you like, on that previous masking. And we just have to act much more quickly on addressing climate change than we already are.
Yep.
But there is a second alternative that the Reef Restoration and Adaptation Program is working on. And I should stress, really, not as an either-or alternative, but potentially a short-term option for us to consider while policies on greenhouse gas emissions catch up. And that is that we could potentially look at introducing something to the atmosphere that's natural, that's not going to cause harmful air pollution and not going to cause acid rain, a component of the atmosphere that's already there, like, for example, sea salt. So sea salt is another natural component of the atmosphere that comes out of the ocean. Every time a wave breaks, it releases a little puff of sea salt into the atmosphere. And that also acts as a radiation shield to some extent. And it helps influence how clouds form, and clouds, of course, block a lot more sunlight than the particles themselves. So the Reef Restoration and Adaptation Program is looking into whether we could do this in a really controlled, measured way. I'm running simulations at the moment that are checking all of the potential downstream risks to do our foremost due diligence on this. But this is a potential band-aid solution in the short term while greenhouse gas emissions catch up. So that's what we're working on. This is being looked at, and we're going to make sure that it's all safe before it goes and is implemented.
Desperate times call for desperate measures sometimes, even if, fiddling with the Earth system, we're already doing it unintendedly. So let's make some deliberate decisions. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Rob Ryan from the University of Melbourne.
Together, you and I are going to make the greatest single contribution to science since the creation of fire.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you're listening to Lost in Science.
Now, there are many paths to a Nobel Prize in one of the science fields, just as there are many paths for careers in science. But one that's generally discouraged is testing science on one's own body. It's probably, you know, lab rule number one. Don't sniff all the chemicals.
Why is that a rule?
Because there's a lot of dangerous things in the lab. That's why.
But it also, isn't it one of the loopholes? Like, when you think about research ethics, one of the loopholes is to test on yourself because you don't need ethical approval.
That is absolutely true. I guess the downside of it is that if you are testing on yourself and something goes wrong, who's there to collect the results? In this case that I'm thinking of, probably the most famous example of this is the revelation over 40 years ago by Barry Marshall and Robin Warren that the cause of gastric ulcers was a bacteria. So prior to the work of these two Australians, doctors believed that gastric and duodenal ulcers were caused by stress and, air quotes, lifestyle factors, which is kind of a euphemism for, don't know, but you should drink and smoke less, I think was the general consensus. Famously, Barry drank a brew of a bacteria called Helicobacter pylori in 1985, after demonstrating he didn't already have any in his digestive tract. So he got a full examination, checked there was none of this bacteria in there, sculled a pint of it, and then got really sick. So thus proving that that the bacteria was what caused the gastric ulcers.
What led them to that hypothesis, do you know, Stu?
They had done biopsies of a lot of patients who had gastric ulcers, and they kept finding this bacteria. And they went, well, that seems like that's the common factor. They looked at all the lifestyle factors and all these other things. They said, we can't see anything else. This bacteria is nearly always there. So that's what led them to the conclusion.
Which is where the research ethics thing come in, because can you, if you believe this is going to make someone sick, can you give it to someone else? And the answer is probably no.
Well, no.
You can't.
Yeah, you shouldn't.
But you can give it to yourself.
You shouldn't be deliberately infecting people with an infective agent. And yes, it would be hard to get ethics approval for such an experiment. But basically, he made himself sick, proved he had gastric ulcers, then cured himself with a short course of antibiotics. Now, this solved a relatively serious problem. Many people had chronic ulcers in their digestive tracts as a result of this bacteria, and only the symptoms were being treated prior to this. So people would take antacids and limit their diets, and that still meant they got ongoing flare-ups and pain and dietary restrictions. And it was a huge problem. 1 in 10 people got a gastric ulcer at some point in their life. So you're talking like a huge proportion of the population. So it was also later found that the ulcers often went on to become cancerous. So gastric and duodenal cancers were caused by the same bacteria ultimately. So rightly so, the pair were awarded the Nobel Prize in 2005 for their work on the problem. Now you might think that was a brave thing to do, but as you said, Chris, it does get around the ethics approval problem because, hey, if anyone can do it, I can do it to myself. And that is one way around that. And I'm sure Robin Warren was standing there at the ready just in case anything went wrong to collect the results.
Do you reckon they rock, paper, scissors about who would take it? Like, was there any discussion? I mean, it happened in the 80s. Surely there are interviews and plenty of discussions around.
Oh, they're still around.
How so, they came to that decision.
It would be interesting to find out. But you might, you know, it's still not. It's not something to be encouraged in science to run experiments on yourself just to prove people wrong. Although, you know, trying to prove people wrong is a good motive for doing science. But it was relatively controlled, as I said. Now, you might also think people surely wouldn't be so reckless as to try something like this now, but there are 8 billion people in the world and so many scientific questions yet to answer. So we'll take a little trip now with Christopher Columbus, who brought back many souvenirs from the Caribbean aboard the Santa Maria, including a little hitchhiker called Tunga Penetrans. Now, you may not know of Tunga Penetrans, but if you've ever been to sub-Saharan Africa, you may well step on it. This little insect is known as the sand flea, and it's a parasitic critter that burrows into the bare feet of unsuspecting beachgoers and has become established in sub-Saharan Africa since the 16th century, thanks to Columbus and his buddies bringing it back with him. So infestations can lead to multiple sand fleas infesting patients' feet, and with no other treatment available, surgical removal is the only option to get rid of them. In the absence of a surgeon, the pain and irritation of the infestations leads people to do it themselves with stuff they can find, which is not necessarily hygienic, and it leads to secondary infections and potentially permanent deformations of the feet and all sorts of things, which don't sound very much fun to me. So as a health problem, it's being studied by, you know, health experts from all around the world, and a German PhD student named Marlena Teleka, I think that's how you pronounce her name, went to Madagascar to study patients who had contracted the parasite in their own feet, and she contracted one in her own foot. So one of the fleas moved into her foot, and she thought, well, I'm studying them anyway. Why don't I just leave it there for a while? And so that's what she did. She was studying the life cycle of the flea. So she thought, well, I've got one 24 hours, 24/7 example that I can study. So she studied it. And rather than dig it out, she let it live in her foot. Unusually, it did not attract further parasites, and that I'll come back to that in a minute. But the thing to remember is bare feet, right? So people walking around in bare feet, that's how you contract them. If you stop having bare feet, you'll not contract them and you'll potentially not get more of them. But they do attract other ones, which is part of the story as well. So she let it remain embedded in her foot so she could observe it directly. Now, individually, they don't live very long. They lay eggs and they die in a month or so. But the female in Marlena's foot lived for 2 months before she removed it. And she removed it because it started to affect her ability to walk. So that's a pretty good reason to get rid of it. Now, she went back to Berlin and she described all of her observations. And she and her supervisor came up with the hypothesis that the female, so only female sand fleas embed in the skin, the female remained unfertilized and was waiting for a mate to come along. So that's why it stayed alive for a lot longer than their usual life cycle. And because she'd worn socks every day after the flea embedded in her foot, no other fleas could get into the foot to mate with the female. So it couldn't lay any eggs, so it stayed alive waiting to get fertilized to lay more eggs, kind of in a kind of stasis waiting for fertilization. So this was a new observation because previously people have studied these sand fleas because they're a major health problem in sub-Saharan Africa and other parts of the world. It was previously thought the females embedded after mating to feed on the blood of their hosts and help the eggs develop. So a new life cycle, they've possibly identified a new life cycle than what was previously thought for these sand fleas because of her observations.
I have a question about the mating location.
Mm.
Is it in the foot? Is it on the foot?
So the female flea is kind of sticking out of the foot.
The female flea is sticking out of the foot. And then
and the males come along and find the bit that's sticking out and mate with it.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So you said you'd come back to this, but how does the males must find the females from scent or from sound?
So they're releasing pheromones, they think, and this is, they've noted that one embedded flea attracts more fleas. So they're attracted to something. The fact that she was wearing socks mean they couldn't get to the other flea that was in her foot. It is a pretty gross story, but yeah. So,
and when did this happen? Is this ongoing?
Yeah,
This is in the last
couple of years. She's obviously removed it because she removed it before she left Madagascar. I'm not a huge fan of allowing parasites to become embedded so I can study their life cycle. I've seen Alien enough to know you don't break the biosecurity protocols. But it's an interesting way to find out new information. But look, okay, for a happy and hopefully less icky ending, I've got a little short story about a different parasite called the threadworm, which is...
No, not the threadworm.
Yeah, a threadworm. It's kind of parasitic nematode that burrows into skin. Threadworms found all over the world and along with hookworms infect over 500 million people at any given time, causing all kinds of health problems. They go through their life cycles and through infected people's organs, basically. But before they burrow through the skin, they wriggle around for a while on the surface before plunging in headfirst to continue their journey. And recently, researchers at UCLA have found that one of the drivers of their behavior in penetrating the skin is a dopamine signal. And they've discovered that if they disrupt this dopamine signal while they're wiggling around on the skin, they lose interest in burrowing into the skin and they don't enter into the body and they don't cause any problems. So they believe that this may be developed into a kind of topical application, sort of like anti-threadworm Aerogard, that would prevent the threadworms getting under people's skin, which...
So, like, anti-dopamine kind of...
It's something to disrupt that dopamine signal that stops the worms being interested in burrowing. So, yes.
Okay. So, just don't be dissatisfied all the time. No dopamine, you're protected.
I wonder if there's particular people are more susceptible to getting threadworms than others. I don't know if they've done that research.
Wait. And did the researchers from UCLA figure this out by doing this themselves? Like one control group just like scrolled constantly to see how many likes and follows they could get that dopamine hit while the others, I don't know, just sat in a dark room.
I think they were more directly testing the chemical pathways than trying to induce endogenous dopamine in the test subjects. But, yeah, look, I think we should wrap it up there. Apologies for the gross subject matter, but I hope I've managed to worm my way out at the end.
You got soul, that's for sure.
Glad I've been all better flea now. And that's it for another episode of Lost in Science. Lost in Science is recorded for 3CR in Melbourne on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. And it airs across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We would love you to get in touch with us. You can email us at lostinsci@gmail.com, or you can find us on Facebook, we're Lost in Science on 3CR, or on Twitter, where we're at lostinscience1. You can find us on your favourite podcast app, where if you get the chance, please give us a good rating and review, as that will raise us up in the search rankings so other people can find the science. Or you can listen to us however you listen to us now, where at the same time every week, Claire, Stu and Chris get
Lost in Science!
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.